Otago Community Radio is proud to celebrate International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. We will celebrate children from around the world and honor the diverse cultures that exist and thrive in the Portland area. The International Children's Day festivities will offer a rich intercultural program that will include singing, acting, puppet shows, arts and crafts, and ethnic food. Again, that's International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. The keynote speaker will be Sherry Hunkala, a national activist in anti-poverty movements and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:02 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, host Per Fogring speaks with writer Allison Weir about her new book, Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the United States Was Used to Create Israel. At 9:30, Janka Soderberg speaks with Craig Corey about his family's appeal of an Israeli verdict that ruling that the government was not responsible for the death of his daughter, Rachel Corey. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Ash Flashpoints asks, was the Egyptian election rigged? At 11, it's the Radio Zine. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can fix that when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today.
Well, good morning. My name is Per Fogring, and this is a special show today where our guest is Allison Weir, the author of Against Our Better Judgment, and she will be in town next Tuesday, June 3rd. She'll be speaking at the East Side Democratic Club, their regular monthly meeting. It's at 12 noon between noon and 2 p.m. Lots of chance to hear her and ask questions, I guess. And she will be at the Grace Presbyterian Church. And that's in the Cully neighborhood, at the Five Corners neighborhood in Cully, at 6025 Northeast Prescott. So that's next Tuesday, June 3rd, from noon until 2 p.m. at the East Side Democratic Club meeting at the Grace Presbyterian Church in the Cully neighborhood. So, Allison Weir, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, it's a very interesting book. It's the subtitle is The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. So I would imagine this goes back a ways. Where do we start with this topic?
Well, we basically start in the late 1800s. When there was a Zionist movement in the United States that was already becoming significant by the 1910s.
Really? Because they started in Switzerland or something, didn't they? How did they jump across?
Well, the first international conference was in Basel, mm-hmm. in Switzerland, that was attended by some Americans. But really, almost concurrently, you know, very quickly, a parallel and connected movement. You know, this was a worldwide movement. So the conference in Basel was an international conference. My book emphasizes and focuses on the U.S. aspect of this international movement and what occurred here and when that started. And I was surprised. Because most of us that have looked into this know that it, its origins are basically given at, with that Basel conference. But I didn't know there was such a very significant movement in the United States right from that same period onward.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write about sort of a mysterious group called the Parushim.
That's right.
Which is, that sort of means that's the Hebrew for the Pharisees, sort of the rabbinical branch of Judaism, which survived the end of the Temple era in Palestine. So who were the Pharisees? Go ahead.
It's a Hebrew word that, as you say, means Pharisees and separate. This is a secret society that was begun in the United States in around 1914. And Louis Brandeis, who was a very prominent Supreme Court justice, was a leader of this secret society. You know, I was astounded when I came across this information. It was in an excellent book published by a mainstream publisher, by a mainstream author named Peter Gross. The book is called Israel in the Mind of America. Gross was a New York Times diplomatic correspondent. Then he was at Harvard for a number of years. He authored a number of very mainstream establishment books, non-fiction books. And this book on Israel contains this information that was astounding to me. There's several pages on it in that book. He also writes about it in a few other articles, about a secret society in the United States with major people members of it. The most prominent one was Louis Brandeis, but there was also a Wisconsin professor, University of Wisconsin professor, Horace Cowan was the actual founder of it. And their purpose was to push this political movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. Back at a time when Palestine was inhabited by a population that, by that time period was about, it was still about 80% Muslim and about 15% Christian. So it was would basically push out the indigenous population to create a Jewish state, because the Jewish population at that time originally had only been about 5%. By 1914, maybe it was about 10% Jewish.
Well,
so that's pretty startling to have come across that.
One thing I should say about this book is very interesting. The book itself is rather short. The main body is less than 100 pages, but the rest of the book, it is got lots of footnotes, and so it's like lots of references. So if you read this and you question something, or you wanted to find out more about it, half the book is notes and footnotes and references and a bibliography in the back. So you can use this book to do a lot of research.
That was my idea.
Well, at that time, in the history of Zionism, wasn't just Palestine they were thinking about. They were talking about settling in Uganda. And then it's very interesting, because I just read an article, the regular column by Uri Avneri, the Israeli peace activist. And he says that Theodore Herzl was, the Zionists were talking about settling in Argentina, in Patagonia. And this
is
something that's not very well known. Avneri also mentions that Theodore Herzl, and this is a quote, Herzl detested Palestine. Most of all, he detested Jerusalem. Have you heard anything about that before?
Well, I certainly was aware that he had considered other places, and they got an offer from the British, basically, for Kenya, for Uganda, that they could have had that for a Palestinian state. And Theodore Herzl was very much was in favor of it. You know, he didn't care where it was. He wanted a Jewish state, a Jewish nation somewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But and it was a very secular movement. But the other members of the movement did not go along with that at all, and very quickly threw that idea out and insisted that it had to be Palestine. I think largely for two reasons, because it would be good PR, you know, for the world that, you know, they could sort of claim this was a Jewish land and they were just, quote, returning to it, even though that was 2,000 years before and many had no ancestry within that land at all. But it would be a good PR move. Also, I think there was this sentimental attachment, even among Jews, such as the leadership at that time, that were not religious, were not observant, but, you know, next year in Jerusalem kind of saying also resonated with them. So that, you know, they insisted on it being Palestine. He was, mm-hmm. Theodor Herzl is considered the father of political Zionism and was the major founder of it. But he was, of course, wasn't the only leader, and he actually died fairly young. He was about 44 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Zionism moved on without him, and even while he was alive, in a direction that he had not been in favor of.
Well, I guess Herzl was a pretty sophisticated guy, and he did not like living in really hot weather, which kind of ruled out Israel. But it's interesting that, getting back to the Parashim, and they were kind of this behind-the-scenes society, some very influential people, and reading about their initiations and the oath they take, it reminds me very much of Skull and Bones, you know, at Yale, which is also...
Yeah, the difference is the Skull and Bones, you know, whether or not it was significant, some people think it's, you know, very significant. I personally am not so sure that's the case. But, you know, largely it's something that people belong to when they're in college. It's one of these fraternity things. There was a similar thing at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor called Mishigama,
mm-hmm.
where sort of student leaders were tapped and would be part of this semi-secret society. But it's not secret. Everybody, of course, knows about Skull and Bones and about Mishigama. But the Parashim, this was a very secret. Nobody had heard about it. In fact, until I started posting information about this, you could find almost nothing about it on the internet. You know, it was extremely secretive that it even existed. And this was something where Brandeis was a member of the Supreme Court. He was a Supreme Court justice when he was active in the Parashim. So it's a, you know, very significant entity, extremely hidden. And yet it was the main source of information about it is from a scholarly journal called the Journal, let me get the exact title here. It's called the American Jewish Historical Quarterly. It has a long article about it in the December 1975 issue. The author of that article was Dr. Sarah Schmidt, a professor from Israel, from a Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Her field of expertise is modern Jewish history and Zionist history. So, you know, this is extremely reliable information and
mm-hmm.
significant. They were going around, inductees would take an oath in which they promised that the movement of Zionism would be dearer to them than that of, quote, family, of school, of nation. And here you have a Supreme Court justice, a part of that. They recruited people to be part of it. And in 1915, they were already planting the suggestion that the British would gain a benefit from a formal declaration in support of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, of course, very close to what the Balfour Declaration did.
Right, I was going to go on to that.
Later.
That was a very pivotal thing, the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And
that's
I guess the deal was that the American Zionists would promise to, they were going to pressure the U.S. to enter World War One. We didn't actually get into World War One until 3 years after it started. And this is kind of a secret gentleman's agreement to, so that was what the Zionists were promising Balfour in England if they would make this declaration.
That's exactly right. That's, you know, in fact, it's sort of in the Zionists wrote about it afterwards publicly. The British Rite wrote that the Zionists had made them a promise that they had kept it. Some American diplomats had statements about that. So, again, this sort of gentleman's agreement, as they called it, is well documented. It's just that most of us have never heard about it, that this is how the Zionists got the Balfour Declaration, which basically began to open up Palestine to them. Very few people know about the American connection to that. And also that the Balfour wording itself was being drafted over a period of a long period of time, probably about 2 years, and was going back and forth between the United States, between Zionists in the U.S., Zionists in Britain, and the British government. And Lord Balfour, you know, it's called the Balfour Declaration. He is the official signatory of it, but he did not even write it.
Really?
And again, this is, you know, the... all of this is the reason I have so many endnotes, and they're very extensive. Additional information is because it's so surprising. You know, most people don't know this information, so I want to supply people with my sources. They can look into them, and usually there's even much more of significance. I intentionally kept my book short so that most people would have time to read it.
Well, we might remind our listeners that what the Balfour Declaration was all about was that World War One. One of the enemy was the Ottoman Empire, you know, along with Germany and Austria-Hungary. The Ottoman Empire included just about all of the Middle East and, you know, Palestine, and then the Allies, once the war was over and they defeated the Ottoman Empire, they had to divide up the spoils, as it were. And so France got, they got Lebanon and Syria, and then the Brits got Jordan and Iraq and Palestine as a kind of a mandate. The theory was that they weren't given these territories to use as they will. They were supposed to sort of prepare them for nationhood themselves, which was kind of a fiction. But anyway, that was a rationale.
That's right. Exactly. And so therefore, after, you know, by winning the war, World War One, because the U.S. did, of course, come into the side of Britain, even though the American population did not want to join the war, and even though Woodrow Wilson had won the presidential election with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," but then a few years later, he plunged us into the war. Mm-hmm. So the British side and the American side then won that war, meaning that it defeated the Ottoman Empire. And at that point, when they divided it up and the British, you know, got the mandate over Palestine, this Balfour wording, in which the British would facilitate or enable, they say, you know, look with fondness or something, look with favor on the establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. Yeah, so it was a very significant development.
So basically,
previously, the British had been turning the Zionists down, mm-hmm. just as other great powers had done. But, you know, once they made this arrangement and they won the war, then things changed.
So in a way, you could say this was the Allies, the victorious Allies, were basically disposing of property that they didn't own. You could even say the Ottoman Empire didn't own Palestine. I mean, they ruled it, but you know, there were people living there who probably wanted nothing to do with the Ottoman Empire.
Well, you know, what's interesting is at the Paris peace talks after World War One, when they were, you know, deciding many questions, and especially dividing up the lands and determining what would be done, there were a number, the U.S. State Department was actually arguing for self-determination for the peoples of the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was the time period that Woodrow Wilson was enunciating his 14 points and making strong statements about self-determination of peoples, the idea that people would form their own governments. And so the State Department had memos saying, well, listen, you know, to be in accord with that statement, the people of Palestine and the people of the Middle East should be allowed to do that. Some of the major American religious leaders at the time went to Paris and Versailles during this time to lobby on behalf of the Arab peoples to have self-determination. But the Zionists went there, including Louis Brandeis and some very significant Zionist delegations, went there to push for the British to get the mandate over Palestine and for it to include this wording that it would then a Jewish home would be created there. And as they wrote at the time, the, quote, Jewish home was a euphemism for what would become a Jewish state.
So they never actually defined homeland? Because that guy, he can take that in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And they never defined the borders, and they still have not.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, you know, we hear this myth that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, but it never even defined its borders intentionally because it planned to expand them. As we see today, it continues to expand them. So no one really knows what the borders are of Israel. It also, of course, has no constitution. And all modern nations have constitutions. The only one I can think of that does not is Britain, that has centuries of common law.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting that from the very beginning, Israel did not declare its borders. It still does not do so. There's a, quote, armistice line, which is the green line that, of course, they completely ignore and continue to confiscate Palestinian land and expand the Israeli borders, you know, the sort of unofficial but de facto Israeli borders.
I just read, I think it was just this morning on the Internet, one of the Israeli politicians, Naftali Bennett, he came, well, maybe he's been saying this for a while, is that the he says Israel should just annex the West Bank, not just a few of the settler enclaves, but in the entire West Bank, which, of course, they call Judea and Samaria. So, basically, he is advocating it would be a one state, but then who runs it, you know?
Well, the only reason they haven't done that is they don't want the people.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's too obvious today to do a massive ethnic cleansing of the type that they did in 47 to 49, and to a smaller degree in 67. So, you know, the problem is that they sort of basically have done that, and then they have these little Bantustans within it that they, you know, allegedly are under the Palestinian Authority. So overall, they basically have done that. And on a lot of Israeli maps, there is no border. You don't see the West Bank and Gaza as separate. There's all just one map. But getting back to the U.S. connection that's made all of this possible, see, the only reason Israel is able to do this is because the U.S. government gives it over $8 million per day of our tax money, and because we shield Israel from the international justice that other groups have tried to secure. We veto Security Council resolutions, etc. And that's done because there's an extremely powerful Israel lobby in the U.S. that largely succeeds in its objectives. Not always, but in most cases it does. And what was interesting to me to see is how far back that lobby has been in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it started in the late 1800s.
That's
got a major boost in 1914 when Louis Brandeis became the head of World Zionism. Then by 1943, there was a group called American Zionist Emergency Council that already in 1943 had a budget of $500,000 at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. And then within a few years, they had access to an even larger fund that had $14 million, and then $150 million before 1950. In today's dollars, that's probably the equivalent of about $1 trillion back in the 40s that they were using to target every sector of American society for manipulation and propaganda. They targeted congresspeople, clergy, Christian clergy, editors, professors, business and labor, Jewish war veterans. They were going after every sector of the U.S. population to push this Zionist ideology. For many decades, the Jewish population of America was not Zionist. In fact, many were even actively anti-Zionist.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So they manipulated that population as well as the general population. And with $1 trillion, it's not surprising that you would become successful.
It's interesting, the Zionist lobby in some ways it reminds me of the, I don't know if people, not many people remember the China lobby of around 1950, which was very powerful also, but When you think about it, the China lobby didn't last that long. It grew out of the expulsion of the nationalists from China, and it kind of had a couple decades of power, but then they sort of went away. The Israel lobby, like you said, has started long before and is still with us. I sense it's kind of weakening in some ways right now, but maybe that's just...
Well, I would say I've been working on this issue now for about 14 years, and definitely there have been significant changes. I mean, for one thing, more people have become aware that there even is an Israel lobby. When I was first looking into this issue, almost nobody had heard of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. In the left, there were and actually still are sort of denialists of the Israel lobby, which is laughable because even Fortune magazine usually puts it as the second most powerful lobby in the United States. And AIPAC is just sort of the tip of the iceberg because, you know, when you look at websites, and I've done this, of a multitude of institutions in the U.S., you find very publicly that they advocate on behalf of Israel. You have the Anti-Defamation League, which has a massive budget. You have the Jewish Community Relations Councils, which exist in almost every city, certainly just about every state, the Jewish Federations, Hillel's on campuses, and all of these very publicly admit and announce that they work for Israel. Mm-hmm. So this is an extremely significant, you know, lobby. The budgets of these organizations are always in the millions, you know, often in the multi-millions. AIPAC itself has an annual budget of at least $40 million.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, it's extremely entrenched, and yet invisible to many people. You know, it's... What struck me in this book and during my research, which I've done over the past dozen years, is that there is this extremely significant political movement and ideology in the United States that has impacted our country profoundly and impacted, of course, the Middle East tragically and the world dangerously, and that this political movement, which is political Zionism, I don't believe I'd ever even heard of it.
Mm.
If somebody asked me, you know, 12 years ago, or went on, you know, out on the streets of Portland and asked the average shopper, you know, what do you think of Zionism? What do you think of Zionists? I think I would have said, what is that? You know, I think I've heard that term. Now, what is it again? You know, I think most people could not even come close to defining it. And yet it's extremely significant.
I think
that in itself is something to ponder.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to have to end it there because our time is up. But we've been talking with Allison Weir, the author of Against Our Better Judgment. And if you want to find out more about this, two ways you can do it. One is to buy her book or get it from the library because it is amply footnoted. Lots of avenues for research are presented. And also, she will be in Portland next Tuesday, June 3rd, at the Eastside Democratic Club, and that from noon until 2 p.m., and that is at the Grace Presbyterian Church, which is at Five Corners in the Cully neighborhood, 6025 Northeast Prescott. So, Allison Weir, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and people can get the book on Amazon, too.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you very much. Stay tuned, folks.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Jenka Soderberg speaks with Craig Corey about his family's appeal of an Israeli verdict ruling that the government was not responsible for the death of his daughter, Rachel Corey. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints asks, Was the Egyptian election rigged? Also, a group of Nobel laureates question whether Human Rights Watch has been infiltrated and watered down by its close connections to the U.S. State Department, and a report from the Electronic Intifada. On the Radio Zine, starting at 11, host Bruce Silverman marks today as an important day in KBOO's proto-history, 1964 to 1968. And at 11:30, Megan Murphy, founder and editor of the website Feminist Current, talks about the killings committed by Elliot Rodger and the misogynist cultural messages we see today. Keep it locked right here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland, your community radio.
Nine years after filing a civil lawsuit against the State of Israel for the wrongful death of American peace activists.